Welcome back to Through the Word. I'm your host, Peyton Jones, and today we'll be in Acts chapter 17, going from plan A to plan B. Have you ever had a trip you meticulously planned, but it went sideways, and you had to shift from plan A to plan B? Maybe you planned your summer camping holiday, but it got derailed by a record storm front that rolled in and threatened to wash you away. Or maybe Wally World was closed when your station wagon got there. The events in Acts 17 were certainly not Paul's plan A, but often our plan B is God's plan A, as we'll soon see as we get started in this chapter. Let's join the boys on mission in verse 1. When Paul and his companions had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a Jewish synagogue. As was his custom, Paul went into the synagogue, and on three Sabbath days he reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and proving that the Messiah had to suffer and rise from the dead. "This Jesus I am proclaiming to you is the Messiah," he said. Some of the Jews were persuaded and joined Paul, as did a large number of God-fearing Greeks and quite a few prominent women. But other Jews were jealous, so they rounded up some bad characters from the marketplace, formed a mob, and started a riot in the city. Wait, Paul's presence caused a riot? The Archbishop of Canterbury once famously said, "Wherever I go, they throw tea parties. Wherever Paul went, they threw a riot." You can read more about what happens. It involves beating people in the streets and having to smuggle Paul and his companions out in the middle of the night under the cover of darkness so that Paul can move on safely to the next town. Well, there goes plan A. Time for plan B. We'll catch up with Paul in the next town over in verse 11. Paul goes to the town of Berea, and we're told, "Now the Berean Jews were of more noble character than those in Thessalonica, for they received the message with great eagerness and examined the Scriptures every day to see if what Paul said was true. As a result, many of them believed, as did also a number of prominent Greek women and many Greek men." Did you catch in verse 11, the Bereans were of more noble character than those in Thessalonica? It means that they actually checked the Scriptures. They were open-minded. They found out that Paul was talking sense. As a result, many came to faith. Plan A was going so well in Berea. But then, the same troublemakers who started the riot back in Thessalonica arrive in Berea, triggering an end to Plan A there too. Cue up Plan B again, boys. So Paul sets out for the next town, but this time, Paul leaves Silas and Timothy behind to continue the work started in Berea and Thessalonica. You see, from Berea, they can sneak back into Thessalonica and keep ministering there and to the Bereans at the same time. This accidental strategy of Paul leaving people behind, arguably his plan B, actually will start to become his plan A throughout the rest of his entire ministry. But let's pick up the story again in verse 15. "Those who escorted Paul brought him to Athens and then left with instructions for Silas and Timothy to join him as soon as possible. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with both Jews and God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace, day by day, with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to debate with him. Some of them asked, 'What is this babbler trying to say?' Others remarked, 'He seems to be advocating foreign gods.' They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, 'May we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we'd like to know what they mean.' All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas." Well, in case you ever wondered what it would be like to be a fly on the wall when Paul preached, witnessing his magnificent oratory, or listening to his brilliant knowledge an unequaled mind in action? Well, verse 18 tells us the crowd wasn't that impressed. Verse 18, what's this babbler trying to say? But verse 21 tells us that they so loved hearing the latest ideas that though they were confused, they're also intrigued. So Paul goes to the Areopagus with him, and he goes for it. But not only does he go for it, he switches his tactics so they'll finally understand him. Verse 22. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you're very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. So, you are ignorant of the very thing you worship? And this is what I'm going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in temples built by human hands. And he's not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. From one man he made all the nations, that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he's not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by human design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. For he has set a day when he'll judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He's given proof to this to everyone by raising him from the dead. When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, but others said, "We want to hear you again on this subject." At that, Paul left the council. Some of the people became followers of Paul and believed, and among them was Dionysius, a member of the Areopagus, also a woman named Damaris, and a number of others. There's a lot to unpack here. In fact, Paul switches his tactics up, and he sets the stage. He brings them context, this unknown God. This God that you're worried you missed out on, well, you did, and I'm going to preach him to you now. His name is Jesus. Giving people context so they don't think you're babbling is a missionary term called contextualization, and Paul, after all, was a missionary. So much so that he even quotes their own poet Aratus, a Greek philosopher who wrote a poem about Zeus. You probably didn't realize that the very words, "for in him we live and move and have our being," is a direct quote from that poem about Zeus himself. He applies it to God, and it may shock you to hear Paul quoting pagan sources, especially ones about pagan deities like Zeus, and applying them to the God of the Bible. But this is what a good missionary always does. You know, when I was a missionary speaking to biblically illiterate people, I used everything I could from pop culture to help people understand the gospel, whether it was Star Wars, The Matrix, The Lord of the Rings, you name it. You see, sometimes when people only think we're babbling, like Paul, we need to change tact a bit and speak using terms and ideas they already know. Rockstar Bono from the band U2 did this once with an interviewer who was fascinated by his profession of faith. Bono told him, "It's a mind-blowing concept that the God who created the universe might be looking for company, a real relationship with people. But the thing that keeps me on my knees is the difference between grace and karma." "I haven't heard you talk about that," the interviewer said. Bono says, "I really believe we've moved out of the realm of karma into the one of grace. You see, at the center of all religions is the idea of karma. You know, that what you put out comes back to you, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Karma seems to be at the very heart of the universe. And yet, along comes this idea called grace to upend all that. Grace defies logic and reason. Love interrupts, if you like, the consequences of your actions, which in my case is very good news indeed, because I've done a lot of stupid stuff." "I'd be interested to hear that," Well, that's between me and God, Bono said. But I'd be in big trouble if Carmo's finally going to be my judge. You see, grace doesn't excuse my mistakes, but I'm holding out for grace. I'm holding out that Jesus took my sins onto the cross, all my bad karma, because I know who I am, and I hope I don't have to depend on any good karma or religiosity. The Son of God who takes away the sins of the world, the interviewer says. I wish I could believe that. That response by that journalist is actually shared by the crowd, who fall into three categories in verse 32. When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, but others said, "We want to hear you again on this subject." But verse 34 says some of them believed. Be encouraged when people say, "I want to hear more about this," and know that God's plan A for everyone is that they would believe and trust Him.
Join us next time as we continue the journey, one chapter at a time. And remember, faith comes by hearing, and hearing through the Word.